Minutes after 8 in the morning. Present at the table are Senators Petrula, Rieger, Sharp, and Pierce, and Senator Frank is hovering. We're bringing back Senate Bill 312, the School Construction Grant Review Bill. There are proposed amendments that have been developed by Senator Rieger, and there is from the department a breakout of portable units in schools in Alaska. This was a study in April of 91, and at that time, 16 of the 54 school districts reported having portable units in use. Anchorage had 98, 50 of which were over 20 years old. Mat-Su had 54, and Fairbanks had 28, 17 of which were over 20 years old. Kenai, 22 total. Craig and Alaska each reported only having one. One of the things that my concern as in supporting Senator Rieger's amendment on Monday was my concern about schools where we brought in so many portables that were so far over population the school was built for that the kids don't have access to adequate library facilities or other facilities in the school, and Senator Rieger and I both, in discussing that, agree that because of the so much square feet per student, those schools would probably still be eligible for new construction, or those districts would probably still be eligible for new construction grants, or certainly for for bonding. And then we talked about what the description that he's got in the new amendment 4 means, and I guess Senator Rieger, you want to go ahead and move your amendment and we can have that discussion.
Okay. I'll move amendment number 4, ask unanimous consent, and hope that someone objects. Madam Chairman, the language is what we discussed on Monday with the and it's the bold-faced about two-thirds of the page down on page 1 of the amendment, and then about just near the bottom of the page on page 2 of the amendment. It says in this subparagraph, unhoused includes conditions in which students are housed in temporary facilities. And the debate at the very end of the meeting when surrounded, well, what about temporary facilities that have been upgraded with with plumbing, heating, permanent foundation underneath, who knows what all, but there might be a point where there wasn't a lot of sympathy from some members there on the table of calling those students unhoused. And to try to accommodate their concerns, I added the clause that are determined by the department to be materially substandard. And I don't feel strongly about that last clause, but put it in to try to accommodate those concerns. And I would be happy to move it with or without that clause, depending on what the will of the committee.
Okay, are there questions for Senator Rieger? I guess, Senator, what would you consider to be materially substandard?
Well, the experience that we've had in Senate Finance of the fire marshal's tours around the state is that almost anything can be found to be substandard. So I felt that there had to be at least some kind of leeway for the department to not have the smallest discrepancy with code become a substandard facility. So I would think that a facility that doesn't have an enclosed walkway to the rest of the school doesn't have plumbing would be the kinds of things which would be substandard. Inadequate heating.
We do have the department here. Dwayne, do you have any comments on this? And Jerry, you're welcome to join us at the table if you'd like.
Chairperson, if there's a comparison made in given areas, of course, these portables, by comparing them to the basic school facilities, are mostly these very, very substandard. So it's got to have a little. I agree with Senator Rieger that they've got to have a little bit of leeway, and materially probably the little discussion and definition here is probably adequate. But you walked from a nice new schoolhouse directly into a portable, and it's quite a shock. More than likely, you have to have a little bit of sense and just compare the portable to, is it lighted? Is there basic rectangle, well lit, warm, some not too much resonance, et cetera, et cetera. So I believe there ought to be a little discretion, all right. I think Senator Zicker, or the right, Senator Rieger.
Dwayne, any comments?
Madam Chairman, just a brief comment. The amendments proposed are in line with where the Bond Reimbursement and Grant Review Committee discusses the future to be, and also in line with a request the Department of Education received from the Anchorage Caucus suggesting that, at a minimum, all students housed in portables in situations where the number of students enrolled at the facility exceed 110% of the design capacity of the core areas of the building. So there's certainly no conflicts with what the committee is doing under their statutory obligation and the amendment as it's proposed.
Senator Kachula?
I'll get into just slightly. House Bill 37 was written. I don't know how much we've done that, but life, health, safety features showed pretty much that, with a rare exception, all new construction is paid for by the state would be Burrow and Bush, because there's no basements in churches and so on to put kids. So now, going from that back up here in your decisions now, whether we go bonding or what, when you get a substantial percentage of the students in this type of facility too, it seems to me it begins to become incumbent upon the Department of Education to have a look at what's going on. We've had a rapid shift of population in two or three of these districts. And, way too large a percentage of them are being housed in this type of facility, and there ought to be, DOE ought to be thinking as a think tank on how to be of some assistance in putting them in perspective for prioritization. Thank you, Chairperson.
Any other comments? There is a motion on the table. Is anyone opposed to Amendment Number 4? Okay. Amendment Number 4 will be added to a Finance CS for Senate Bill 312. Senator Rieger, Number 5.
Madam Chairman, at the very end of the last meeting, a question was raised about what happens if a bond is issued which sells at a premium. And I think an example would be where a certain dollar amount of projects is approved by the department, and the local school district issues bonds in a face amount equal to that dollar amount approved for the project, but puts a high interest rate on them, an artificially high interest rate, and the bonds sell at a premium to the face amount, so some extra cash comes into the municipality. And the department, in such a case, testified that they would try to compensate for that by adjusting back the amount by which they the amount they would reimburse back to a kind of an equivalent reimbursement if the bonds were issued at par. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I understood the testimony to be that way, and it seemed to me that at best the department would be kind of behind the eight ball to try to catch a situation like that and then compensate adequately for it. And what Amendment Number 5 does is to try to put a penalty on top of that. In other words, instead of just reducing by 100% of that premium and compensating, there should be some a little extra reduction. And I drafted an amendment which says 200%. That might be excessively punitive, but I think that there should be some kind of a disincentive for a district to issue bonds at premium. Generally, it's my impression of the financial markets that bonds that sell at premiums are not an efficient way to issue bonds. You generally don't get your money's worth when you do a premium to par type issue. I'll move amendment number 5 so we can have it for discussion. I appreciate testimony from the department.
Okay, the amendment has been moved. Ms. Wiley?
Madam Chairman, our understanding of the amendment utilizing the example that was given yesterday, if I recall, the example was given that bonds might be available at 115 as compared to par, and my understanding of this amendment would then require that the department would reduce the eligible reimbursement to the district then by 200% of that 15% increase over par, which the end result would be then a 30% reduction in the 70% reimbursement rate. And again, that would then provide the penalty for selling the bonds over par, keeping in mind that the state does reimburse 70% of the principal amount as well as 70% of the interest amount. Thereby, if the interest amount is higher than what is necessary given the current market conditions, the district would be making themselves eligible for a greater level of reimbursement from the state. So this would deter that from happening.
So, go ahead, Senator Rieger, and then Senator Schultz.
The way this would work, as you understand, is that the new higher debt service would be what would be reduced by the additional, in that example, 30%.
That's the way I'm reading
this. This wouldn't be on top of your own internal compensation to try to adjust back. It would be above the compensation that you otherwise would be trying to do.
Under the current statutory definition of cost of school construction, yes.
Senator Sharp.
So I can get it through my little brain. The difference between the additional debt service, which would be interest primarily because it would be the higher interest rate and the principal would still be the same, would be subject. For instance, on a $10 million bond issue, if the interest rate was 5% higher than going rates, that 5% would be the twice that 5% would be the deduction.
Yes.
Or twice the interest caused by the 5%. That's what I'm saying. And nothing to do to reduce the normal $10 million debt, though, because that's
through the chair, Senator Sharp. I'm sorry. I read the amendment to apply to all of the eligible reimbursement, which would include the reimbursement of the principal amount as well. I may be in error, but that's the way I understood the amendment to read.
Oh. Okay, so that is a little severe.
It would probably work.
Well, Madam Chair, just one thing. I didn't notice this when it was being drafted, but the wording of the amendment says bond sells at a premium to par value, and actually that should be an original issue premium, because in the secondary market they go up and down. And either for the record or to correct that should be original issue.
Which would be where, Senator Rieger?
On page 4, the second line, it would read, by which a bond sells at an original issue premium.
Okay. Do you have that?
I'd move that as an amendment to the amendment.
Okay, there's an amendment to the amendment. Actually, we can't because we don't have Senator Cotullo at the table and we don't have 4. He's coming back.
Oh, okay. Still in the room.
Okay, there is an amendment to the amendment. Is anyone opposed? Okay, so we have amendment number 5 before us. This is certainly a substantive change. Does anybody in the audience wish to testify on this amendment? Senator Sharp.
We have the representative of the department walk us through that example I give.
Sure.
And how this would apply and exactly how much the principal amount of the $10 million would go down to that wouldn't be subject to reimbursement, or the 70% would go down. I'm primarily interested in making sure that they aren't reimbursed for hyperinflated interest rates, but whatever the normal rate would have been, I don't have a problem with. But I don't. Anyway.
Madam Chair, referring to page 3, section 3, subparagraph O, the amendment states the percentage of bonded school construction debt that a municipality is eligible to be reimbursed. continuing on the next page, shall be reduced by 200% of the fraction, the numerator being the amount by which the bond sells at the original issue premium to par value, and the denominator being the par value. I read that to mean that the total reimbursement to the district would be reduced by that fraction. Under current statute, districts are eligible to receive 70% reimbursement of principal and associated financing costs. I would read this then to require the department to calculate the fraction. In the example yesterday, that fraction would have been 15% basically multiplied by the 200% to provide a penalty of 30% on the total reimbursement. So a 30% reduction to the 70% reimbursement would result in a 21% reduction of the 70%, if you will, if I'm reading that correctly.
That's the way my numbers come out.
That's how I read.
So the 70% would go down roughly to 56%. Somewhere in that.
Yeah, 115 times 0.49. See what that is.
Through the chair, as you stated earlier, Senator Sharp, the reimbursement amount on the principal would remain unchanged. The state's obligation on the interest for bonds that carry a higher interest rate than market value would require would place a greater obligation on the state. The at the point at which there would be a break even, if you will, I'm not sure. I have not calculated that at the present time.
Let's talk about the double penalty on the would that get us there?
Trying to think how that would actually play out. You know, in the financial analysis of something, you generally just kind of discount the cash stream, and you don't really care whether it's principal or interest. How accurate it would be to only discount the interest reimbursement.
See an example of, if I may, to the chair, for the example given, that would only reduce the 9% interest by 21%, or the excess. No, the 9%. That wouldn't do it. You'd want to get it down to the 4.5 or whatever the normal rate is.
Do we have a systematic, pilfering of the public purse through very clever maneuvers by many different school districts and boroughs dealing with, usually if you get into something like this, you get some bond council gets pretty clever and starts going around the state telling them how they can organize themselves and pick it up. It's not usually developed locally. Do we have an epidemic of this? We have just happens to be the way the interest rates were this one time and just by accident fell into this. What is your opinion?
Through the chair, based on our analysis of prior bond sales, at least the ballot issues that have been presented to the department for approval carry a interest rate equivalent to current market for the type of security rated. We're not aware of a problem that does exist.
Suppose we somehow sent out a message, don't play games, to all the school districts. You put that, then incline them to do just precisely that once you... I'm sure these guys talk. Districts talk, they meet, superintendent. Any way to pick up a buck, you know, when you get tough times, they'll do it. If it's legal, it may not be moral in the technical sense of the word. I like what's here as an amendment. If we don't create some other problem by adoption, I don't want to reduce beyond the 70% factor. We're not doing it. Logically, this is a good amendment. If there's something else occurring here, then that's nothing I want to participate in.
Go ahead, Senator Sharp.
I do think the amendment would assure that the school districts would strive to get the most possible market interest rate, because otherwise the consequences for creative financing would be a little severe. And I think the message would be loud and clear. Obviously, definitely with this amendment.
Yeah.
Senator Rieger.
Well, actually, now that we talk about this, I hadn't really thought about a different aspect of it, but is it possible that the voters may have only approved, could there be a situation where the voters approve, say, $30 million in bonds, and the school district, and really, I think the proposal doesn't specify the interest rate in the bond ballot issue. So to raise $40 million, is it possible for a school district to just say, well, we'll float them at 12% instead of the prevailing rate of 6? Get the premium, and that's a way of kind of beating the system as far as what the voters authorize, and from the voters' point of view as well as from the school debt reimbursement point of view?
Again, through the chair, under our current system, the state is required to first offer a bond reimbursement authorization, which establishes the maximum principal amount that's eligible for reimbursement. So if a district were to try to manipulate it through receipt of a premium over face value, that premium amount would not be reimbursable. The district, in order to use that money on that project or a different school construction project, would have to first receive approval from the Department of Education.
Yeah, but the premium wouldn't even be reimbursable by the school district because it's a premium.
Yeah.
That's free money.
Free money.
And if, would the... I'm trying to think again of what we did last year in Senate Bill 7. Do all these bonds have to go through the bond bank? I mean, is this up to the discretion of the individual school districts, or does the bond bank now control the floating of these bonds?
Through the chair, currently the bonds are up to the discretion of the individual school district. Only upon passage of a statewide vote and increased authority in the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank would the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank take over the sale of the bonds and, if necessary, refund local bonds.
Okay. Well, I'd say to keep talking, I know Senator Sharp wants to add some things. I think there should be some percentage penalty above reducing by 100% of a fraction, and in part it's just because I subscribe to the notion, and I can't prove it, that premium bond issues are inefficient, and you probably, even if you compensated exactly, you're worse off. There's got to be a kicker in addition. I don't know if it's 110%, 200%, or any range rate between, but I think there should be some penalty, either by regulation, what Senator Katula suggested, just say, look, you know, we disallow whatever we want if we play games, or in statute.
For the record, Senator Kelly joined us some time ago. Senator Jack and Senator Frank are also at the table. We're discussing amendment number 5. Senator Katula.
Is there any little factor following varying districts actually have different bond rates, I suspect, or the state rated differently? So we'd also, you'd have to be very careful to look at what that one would be eligible for in this whole scheme of things. Is that correct?
Senator Reagan?
You couldn't just do a gross that Anchorage got 4.8 and I got Kenai, Mattsu or someplace else had to sell theirs at 9 or something. I mean, there's that damn factor in here too, which some ways leads us to bond bank type approach.
And the point is, you can't assume that there's one interest rate that everybody should have gotten. No. But you know, the range is pretty narrow generally.
Okay. State more or less guarantees it anyway, more or less, moral or something. Well, I'd like to see the, if it does no disservice, I'd like to see this amendment adopted, because why should we let people exploit this? You open the, you know, the Millikens of the world exist at all levels. You open the door and they're there. It's our system. That's probably the best system around, but it's not perfect.
Other questions on amendment number 5? All those in favor of amendment number 5, please raise your right hand. Anyone opposed? Okay, the motion carries. Other proposed amendments? Oh. Does the department yet have the list for Senator Jacko, or for us, in answer to Senator Jacko's question?
Through the chair, I have
a... I'm sorry,
I did have a question. Just to follow up on Mr. Guiley's testimony. The old programs, you know, the bonds have been out there for 2, 5, 7 years. To your knowledge, none of those have sold at a premium, no material premium at all?
To my knowledge, that's correct.
Okay, so this is only... prospective.
To my knowledge, I'd be correct, yes.
Hmm? For the record, Amendment Number 3 had been pending. It was replaced by Amendment Number 4, so we'll just show Amendment Number 3 as having been withdrawn.
What happened to Amendment Number 4?
It passed. It's the rewrite of Amendment Number 3 from Monday, which you didn't like.
Ah.
it's got the Kelly language included.
You take care of everything.
Okay. Now, does the department have the answer to Senator Jack, or to our question in response to Senator Jackson's amendment? I should phrase that correctly, I suppose.
Madam Chairman, I was able to research the most recent school district audits to determine how many dollars were recorded in school district audits for local cash expenditures of capital projects in fiscal year 1993. And based upon that analysis, there was recorded in those audits $9,908,651 of local school construction projects not currently being reimbursed by the state through either a bond reimbursement process or a grant process. So that's an estimate of what exists on the actual school district audits in 1 year of the three-year suggestion for cash reimbursement process. The list includes all 54 school districts under current statute. The REA school districts would not be eligible for such reimbursement of the only municipalities in the boroughs. So just to give you an idea of what exists out there in fiscal year 1993 as an estimate, we were able to take three specific districts and look at the three fiscal years. On the third page, the Aleutian East Borough, the Bristol Bay Borough, and Unalaska school districts, and look at the cash expenditures reported in their books for the three fiscal years. And of the three districts, they totaled $1,061,863 for that three-year time period. There are many footnotes on the page indicating brief descriptions of the specific projects, as well as indicating that on the bottom, some of the issues. The old cash reimbursement program did end with projects that had to be approved prior to July 1, 1990. Therefore, there's a potential of double payment for projects incurred during the time period of April 30, 1990 through June 30, 1990. And the issues that I brought forth in previous testimony related to the two-year lag process, whereby expenses incurred by the district in 1990 under current program would have been eligible for reimbursement in 92. And of course, that fiscal year is currently closed out. So based on the wording under current statute, excluding the proposed amendment, the only expenses eligible for reimbursement would be those incurred in FY 93 prior to April 30 of 93. This would exclude any capital projects that are in fact recorded on the borough books, the city or borough books. We currently do not have access to those. We've requested those, but I'm sorry, I do not have that information available to you today.
But you think the $9 million non-reimbursed cash expenditures for just fiscal year 93, from, or almost $10 million from your audits is a...
That would be a very conservative number in that the cities and boroughs are not required to actually record capital projects related to schools on the school audit. They are allowed to record them in their own audit, in that under state statute they have responsibility for the buildings. So this number would be understated by the amount of projects that are recorded in city and borough audits. And again, given existing statute, it would be overstated in relation to the projects incurred by REAAs. So I understood the question to be, what is the dollar amount expended for local capital improvement projects by districts throughout the state? So in an attempt to answer that question, I provided the numbers for all 54 districts. I apologize for the quality of the copies. I realize I blocked out some names of the districts at the end.
I'm sure.
Senator Jacka.
This list includes projects below $150,000, which were excluded in the legislation.
Yes, through the chair, I thought I heard the question yesterday to refer to projects of all dollar amounts recorded in local capital projects.
Convenient hearing.
Yeah, I know.
I'm sure.
Senator.
Through the chair, the amendment would have called for it from April 90 to April 30th, 93, and this is just for the 93 fiscal year?
Through the chair, Senator Sharp, yes, that's correct.
So So the, let's take the example of Evolutions East and Senator Jacko's memo with, that went with his amendment. They say that the borough spent $1.3 million on upgrade work at King Cove, which doesn't show up on the audits that you have.
Again, Madam Chairman, the $1.3 million in all likelihood is reflected in the borough audit as opposed to the school district audit.
So your $10 million figure, and I agree, it doesn't, it, it isn't just those things that are over $150 million, but it, or $150,000, but it, this is a good example of why it's probably understated.
Excuse me.
Because all Ocean East shows is $84,000.
Yes, Madam Chairman. Given the time frame, we did not have access to the borough audits. Borough districts are not required to send the borough audit to the State Department of Education. We have requested copies of those in an attempt to fulfill the request.
Okay. Senator Sharp, did you have your hand raised? I'm sorry. Somebody had their hand up. Who was it?
Might have been me.
Senator Frank?
I started listening late after you started talking. I apologize. But the non-reimbursed, on the second page, the non-reimbursed, you looked at just the information you have for the school districts for the years that would have been covered by the proposed amendment. Is that right?
To the Chair, Senator Frank, page 2 reflects only the cash expenditures reported in 1983 that were recorded in school district audits.
This one, I'm talking about the next one.
The next one, we took three sample districts and looked at the cash expenditures recorded in all three fiscal years for the period of April 30, 1990 through April 30, 1993.
But you just looked at the school district. You didn't look at the boroughs, right?
That's correct. We did not have access to
and
the borough.
And like in our borough, I think our borough has the responsibility, maybe every borough does, for major maintenance. And so if you just looked at the school district, you'd get a really incomplete picture. You really need to look at the borough, at least in our district's case, unless I'm wrong. If there were, I don't know if there were, but if there were any cash expenditures, it'd be on the borough's list, not on the school list. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, to the Chair, Senator Frank, that's correct. Under state statute, municipalities and boroughs have the responsibility for school construction and major maintenance. Under statute, they may delegate that responsibility back to the school districts, and in some cases that has happened. In most cases, it has not happened.
Okay, so Fairbanks may be an anomaly or an unusual situation?
To the Chair, Fairbanks is probably the standard that the borough still retains responsibility. Anchorage School District, as an example, has delegated their responsibility back to the school district, so their expenditures would be recorded on their books, but in most case, other cases, it would be recorded on the borough books.
What about Kenai? I know Kenai, doesn't the borough do their maintenance for them?
To the Chair, yes, that's correct.
And they've got $1 million in here even from the school district, so.
That's correct.
At Sioux, borough.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, Matt Sioux's showing a zero, and I suspect that's not.
I think the borough runs the whole thing.
Even projects, I mean, even if you net out everything that's under $150,000, you've still got well over $8 million just on this list for 93. So we have no idea what's really out there.
It ought to be separate legislation if we're going to get in. Everybody can make a judgment versus straightening out another problem.
Senator Frank.
The other concern that I have is we're talking about an immediate, I believe, let's see, what it would be 2 years prior, so we'd be talking about an immediate impact on the general fund.
Yes, that's correct. And if it were to pass and be signed into law prior to June 30, 1994, there would be the potential for a request to be submitted for the current fiscal year.
Well, I think we've got more information necessary before we could make any kind of decision. And it could be potentially a pretty large number, unless I misunderstand this, because this is 9 million. Well, there may be a lot of them less than 150,000, but nevertheless, it could be a pretty large number, and we don't know what that number would be, and it would impact us immediately this year.
4.2 million, even if you met the Other comments? What's the will of the committee on Senate Bill 312? Senator Reeder.
I'd like to have it stay in committee for a day just to make sure that anything we did doesn't radically screw anything up. There's two very substantial amendments we put on today. I wouldn't mind holding that and moving it tomorrow just to let's around the state have a look at what we did.
Jerry, where's the House bill?
Waiting for this one.
Is it in finance or somewhere else?
Not sure what the references were on it. I can check on that.
Was it a House Finance Committee bill?
Yeah, I believe it went, Madam Chair, I believe it went Hess and Finance, the same as what Senate bill was.
Okay. Fine, Senator Reeder. I don't mind keeping it until tomorrow, but I guess we'd ask the department or any of the school district lobbyists who are here to let Tundra Drums be utilized and let the other school district lobbyists know, and so that if we have any comments back, because I would like to move this tomorrow morning to get it read across. We do have session tomorrow, and I'd like to have it read across tomorrow.
Do we have session today?
Yeah. Any other comments on 312? Okay.
Got all dressed up. I don't know where to go.
Let's take a brief at ease, and let's call Senator Zaroff's office and let him know that we are ready to take up 92, even though we're running early. We can go on. We do have the commissioner here, so we could go on to 248 if we need to.
Once ready up before 10.
George, I ask Lamar Cotton yesterday. Call Senate Finance back to order. We have Senate Bill 248 to assist and protect vulnerable adults. And we have the commissioner here. This is a one of the governor's bills. In your package, you have a State Affairs CS along with a Hess CS, but the State Affairs CS was the last one. A position paper from the Hess Department in strong support. We have a number of fiscal notes. Three of them are negative fiscal notes, and one is positive. We do have a sectional analysis, and there is a proposed amendment number one from Senator Reeder. Welcome, Commissioner. Would you please walk us through the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Nancy Usera, Commissioner, Department of Administration. As you just summarized, this bill has been heard by two committees. It's strongly supported by the seniors community and is an excellent step towards having a central focal point for the delivery of senior services in the state. The fiscal notes that you have before you are transfers from the Department of Health and Social Services into the Division of Senior Services in the Department of Administration. It is a net zero fiscal impact. This bill does a better job of defining elder abuse, does a better job of indicating what the response needs to be for the various seniors programs and what their responsibilities are, and does a better job of protecting seniors who may find themselves in a vulnerable position. We do have a representative here from the Department of Health and Social Services, and if you have some specific questions, there was significant amendment to this in the Senate Hess Committee, and we believe that this bill currently represents an excellent piece of legislation that we would urge early passage to. I'd be happy to address any questions and committee may have.
Okay, Senator Kelly.
I noticed four no recs and one amend, and four no recs and one do pass. So there must be some reasons for that lack of confidence. Why the Department of Administration?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, as you know, it is the Department of Administration that has housed a majority of the seniors programs. We have currently, through administrative order, created a new division of senior services, which merged the Division of Pioneer Benefits and the Older Alaskans Commission. An accompanying bill to this was actually a three-package bill. The other bill that you had before you today, 250, is the organizational framework for the Division of Senior Services. What this does is it transfers all of the major senior services into a single division. It's the one-stop shopping concept. What's happened in the past is that Health and Social Services has dealt with vulnerable adults as they would with vulnerable children or children in need of aid. The fact is that upon reflection and analysis of the types of programs, truly the needs of children are very, very different from the needs of vulnerable adults. And the determination was made that we could do a better job of serving this constituency if we're putting it in a like framework, which is the common thread here being seniors as opposed to being vulnerability. Consequently, if we follow through on this one-stop shopping concept, it's the Division of Senior Services, which, as you point out, why in the Department of Administration? Because it is.
Because it's right.
Because it's the right thing to do.
Other questions? Senator Rieger, would you like to move your amendment and speak to it, please?
Yes, I'd move amendment number one.
I would object just for discussion, Senator Rieger.
Okay. Madam Chairman, this was an amendment that was put in HESS and I believe taken out in State Affairs, but when I read this bill in HESS, the language which referred from place to place in referred to the state or a police officer or a village public safety officer taking immediate action to protect and so on reminded me of the Busby decision in the municipality of Anchorage. And because of that, I asked for an amendment which was put in HESS, which is intended to preclude a Busby-type outcome. And it says that you can't bring an action just for the discretion of the municipal officer deciding, or state officer deciding not to take immediate action. And that's basically just the amendment.
Senator, do you know why State Affairs took that back out? Was it some specific request of a department, or Commissioner, do you know?
No, Madam Chair, we supported the amendment going in, and we were supported the amendment coming out. Either way is fine with us. I think that certainly Senator Rieger's amendment more narrowly deals with this issue. I believe State Affairs, my recollection of the discussion at that point was they didn't feel it was necessary. We have no feelings about it one way or another.
Okay. Questions for Senator Rieger on this amendment? Any discussion? All those in favor, raise your right hand. Okay, it passes unanimously. Any other questions on the bill? We do have Pat O'Brien also here from Health and Social Services if there are any questions for her. What's the will of the committee on the bill?
Madam Chair, I'd move we report out Senate Bill 248 with individual recommendations, finance version.
Okay. There's a motion to move Senate Bill 248 with individual recommendations and the appropriate fiscal notes. Is anyone opposed? Bill moves. Commissioner, are you also testifying on 250?
Yes, okay, Madam Chairman, I am.
Keep you here then.
Thank you.
Okay, Senate Bill 250 is an act relating to the Yoder Alaskans Commission. We have a State Affairs CS in the file, along with the governor's transmittal letter. The admin fiscal note for this bill is zero. We had an amendment number one by Senator Sharp that was in the bill, but I understand that that problem has been taken care of in the House, and I assume that their bill is ahead of ours. Is that?
It was taken care of in Senate State Affairs.
Oh, in Senate State Affairs.
Yes, okay. Ma'am. Great. It's been taken care of on both sides.
Okay, terrific. Madam Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I previously mentioned, and for the record again, Nancy Usera, Commissioner, Department of Administration, 250 is the administrative piece that goes along with all of the seniors initiatives that we've put forward this session. In order to have a division that effectively and efficiently houses these programs, we felt it was necessary to do some realignment of the old divisions, which were served by two different advisory boards. One was the Older Alaskans Commission, and the other was the Pioneer Home Advisory Board. What this bill does is it maintains both of those commissions separately, but they are housed in the same division, and it aligns them much more closely in that the chairman of each board serves as a member of the other board. So we're having a much more coordinated response to seniors' issues. Secondly, what this bill does is change the name of the Older Alaskans Commission to the Alaska Commission on Aging, which is more consistent with the national model. And in terms of receiving funds from the federal, as you know, we receive a large number of matching funds from the federal government for the administration of these programs. For the record, the amendments that were made in state affairs were in response to a concern by the senior community. The governor's original bill had advanced that the governor would appoint the chairman of each of these boards. It was the feeling of the seniors community that they would like to elect their own chairman from among their number. And while we didn't necessarily agree with that approach, the fact is that it was amended, and we support the bill as it is.
Okay. Any questions of the commission? Senator Kelly, I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
Sure, on page 6, line 19, section 16, providing for a sponsor and then providing for a waiver in the following subsection F. What is that all about?
Madam Chair and Senator Kelly, my recollection of this, and I'm going to have to look behind my... The administrator of the Older Alaskans Commission isn't here. This has to do with matching grant and whether or not the match can be in-kind versus having to be a cash grant. And I believe it's a technical amendment which deals with the grant process under the soon-to-become, hopefully, Alaska Commission on Aging. It's not a substantive change in terms of the current operation.
Chair, I'd like this fleshed out a little bit. Does anybody in the audience know what this section's about? It says the contribution may be in cash or in-kind services. That doesn't seem to be the issue. But for some reason, we want to waive all or part of the sponsor contribution required under this section. I'm just interested in what that means, if the waiver is in the public interest.
Perhaps the reinforcements have arrived.
We're on page 6. Get the section.
Eileen, come ahead and come to the table if you'd like.
Y'all started earlier than we did. Madam Chair, Senator Kelly, it's as I suspected. The short story is that this allows the commission the flexibility to reduce or waive the local match requirements for grantees when waiver is in the public interest. That is, that currently the nonprofits that receive some grants have to have match requirements, and because of the nature of some of these local service senior service programs, they don't necessarily have cash match, but they may have labor, you know, they may donate labor costs or facilities costs, for those kinds of things. What it does is provides additional flexibility.
And this even waives the labor cost.
Senator Kelly, other questions?
Madam Chair, this bothers me a little bit. I mean, if you can't even put some time in as a match, you know, you're not trying very hard. The original program has some kind of a match requirement, either cash or labor, right? And now we're even waiving the labor end of it.
Madam Chair, Senator Kelly, my understanding of this is that this provides regulatory authority for them to establish regulations which would define when a waiver of the match could happen and under what circumstances.
Is it possible, Chairperson, you just have an area which has a series of wheelchair types or something that
I know, Senator Tula. This was part of the governor's original chancellor.
Yes, Madam Chairman.
But we don't know specifics as to why the commission.
The genesis, Madam Chairman, the genesis of this bill was a review by a task force on senior services that was established with both the Elder Alaskans Commission and the administrative representatives of a number of seniors programs. This is their recommendation, and you know, to be very frank with you, the matching requirements and the grant requirements under the Older Alaskans Commission is a fairly esoteric field, and I'm just not intimately involved with it. The director of the division was scheduled to be here this morning. I don't see her yet, but we'd be happy to get back to you with another.
Since we're running early, we could hold this for a few minutes. Go on, if whatever other questions we'll go ahead and take. Hold this, go on to Senate Bill 256, and then come back to 250 when your division director is here.
Yeah, I'd like to see what the requirement the grant provision was.
Sliding into home.
Or at least third.
This falls into the sweating bullets category.
Oh, okay. The question is about sections 16 and 17.
That's the grant waiver.
Page 6 and 7. You are adding a new subsection, subsection F, that would allow the commission to waive all or part of the sponsor contribution if waiver is in the public interest. And Senator Kelly's question, I think it's certainly fair to ask, is why would we ever want to waive all of the sponsor contribution?
Senator Kelly, through the chair, if I may, what we have run into over the years are some circumstances on startup grants, such as the rural delivery of in-home respite care, where since the organization who's providing the grant isn't residing in one location, they may be in Anchorage, but they are literally arranging for respite care in Galena, St. Mary's, any place in the state. They aren't able usually to sort of like the first year raise, they ask the clients for contributions, and they try to chip in some money from their organization. But for instance, a lot of organizations, their match is made up of in-kind donations such as their rent. And these organizations, which are not heavily based on employees but are actually going out and setting up home care services, those types of organizations, we have found it difficult for them, especially in a startup year, maybe the first 1 or 2 years, to come up with a 10% match, even with client contributions. And for instance, by contrast, I would note to you that the grants for home care services for people with developmental disabilities have no match requirement, zero. And so what we've been finding is we've been trying to set up some home care and respite care services similar to those set that system, and finding that in the startup years for some of the services, especially in rural areas, it's very hard to find the match until the program's gotten well established and the clients have gotten used to contributing. It's hard for them to come up with a 10%. It's been quite a barrier to starting some rural delivery services. So we had originally with Department of Law talked about spelling out more what that was, that it was for startup sorts of programs and only for a startup or pilot project period. The Department of Law told us they preferred to have us define that later in regulation and just use a public interest waiver type language in the statute.
Senator Kelly?
I don't think it's unreasonable to define it in statute as opposed to allowing the commission to come up with a waiver. I suspect that their waiver would be a lot broader than the waiver this committee might come up with.
Now, Kelly, do you have proposed, perhaps conceptual language, or did you have language originally that you'd given the Department of Law?
If it could be helpful to the committee, Senator Kelly, through the chair, the statute, what the part, the rest of this statute that's not printed here already defines by statute and by a regulation something called a pilot project. And so we'd be happy to see it be something that we can do it for a pilot project as defined, because it's already defined in both statute and regulation what a pilot project is.
Senator Kelly.
And I would submit on page 7, on line 1, the amendment to read, when awarding a grant to support and scratch a program or and include and insert pilot. a pilot, when awarding a grant to support a pilot project under, et cetera.
Is that the correct statutory site for the pilot?
Yes, that is.
There is a motion, Senator Rieger?
Yeah, I just have a statute here in front of me. It's 4765030 is the pilot project grants. If I read this right.
Yes, and 30 is within this spread of the sections, and so.
Well, we find what a pilot project is.
What's the duration, longest duration, is my question, for a pilot project?
Senator Kelly, do you want to then specify under 4765030, since that's the pilot project?
How long does a pilot project last?
In line two.
It doesn't say how long. Set it in the grant condition, usually 1 to 2 years.
Let's see. When awarding a grant to support a pilot project under 4765010050, isn't that clear enough?
Senator Rieger just said that the pilot projects are 030.
Well, okay. 010 through 050 includes 030, correct?
Yes. Yeah, either way works.
Okay. What about the answer to Senator Sharp's question of how long can a pilot project go on?
Madam Chairman, to Senator Sharp, the pilot project grant section has been used rarely in the past, but it has been used a couple of times. And the regulations that we put in under it just say that the commission makes that determination at the time. We now are on a 2-year grant cycle, so that I would presume that usually it would be a maximum of that first 2 years. Sometimes even pilot projects will start mid-year, so it might be 18 months to 2 years. The pilot project language in 4765030 talks about the fact that to get approved as a pilot project, there has to be an estimated projected cost of operation for the next 3 succeeding years, but it doesn't say that it will be in pilot project status for that long. That's just part of the planning that they have to go through to get approved.
Is it 3 to what years?
The 3 succeeding years, I'm sorry.
3 succeeding years. Madam Chair, I probably have to agree with that the pilot project has probably not been used too often, but with this kind of incentive, it might become more popular. I was just wanting to state for the record that we're talking maximum 3 years.
There is a motion for amendment number 1 on the table. All those in favor of Senator Kelly's amendment, raise your right hand. Anyone opposed? Motion carries. Senator Rieger?
I just had a question. As long as we were talking about the required contribution language, 4765040A, when I looked it up in the statute, I just noticed there's a 4765040B, which seems to go exactly counter to A. It says that the contribution percentage is above 10%. Now, how does that all work? And should we be repealing letter B?
Senator Rieger, through the chair, I wasn't here in 1980 when this was first adopted, and I have to tell you that it is a difficult one. Department of Law and we've worked at it, and basically what it does is, you're right, A contradicts B. B sets a percentage, and then A caps it at 10%. So even though we figured out that most cities and towns larger than about Petersburg would have percentages greater than 10% if we used the formula in subsection B, but then subsection A caps it at 10%. And that has been that way since time immemorial. We've thought about raising it. I have to tell you that it would get to be very difficult. These grants are service grants, and most of the grantees would find 20 or 30% match requirements to be pretty difficult to meet. Well, they're all nonprofit corporations or parts of city government, and the 10% that they now put in is usually pretty significant. And it is, now, community mental health centers, for instance, have 25% match requirements, but they're allowed to charge fees. The federal programs that we run only allow us to ask for suggested donations for the nutrition, transportation, and support services, so that puts a cap on how much we can generate from client fees. The more intensive client services, like adult daycare, can ask for fees because we got them out of federal money, have them all in state funds, and they're able to raise more in client fees. But it's not like a community mental health center that's billing Medicaid and billing insurance companies and so on. So the 10% is probably a real reasonable amount, but it is an old, antiquated statute. We didn't tinker with it in this bill.
So here we go.
Madam Chair, actually, my question was whether to repeal B, not A. And I think that it still might make sense to repeal B if it doesn't apply anyway, because A supersedes it. Why not just take it out of statute as long as we got it?
Senator Rieger, through the chair, we would need to leave, yeah, B could come out as long as C stays, because C is the calculation methodology.
Yeah.
And in some parts of B, well, it would be a little hard to do here on the floor, because you'd have to leave.
Forget it.
I apologize. I haven't looked at this section for a while. You could take B out. I remember it now. Law said we could take B out.
I'll leave it up to the discretion of the chair. You want to do it or you want to let it go?
I'd like to let it go, but what?
Fine with me.
Other questions on the bill? What's the will of the committee on the bill?
Chairperson, I'd move the individual recommendation as amended.
Senator Kutula has moved the finance CS for Senate Bill 250 with the fiscal notes and individual recommendations. Is anyone opposed? Let's go back then to 92. Senator, good morning.
Good morning, Senator.
Hey. In your files for the act relating to an advisory vote during regional educational attendance area school board elections, is the original bill and a union regional substitute position paper in support from the Department of Education and a sponsor statement from Senator Zaroff, who is here with us. Senator Zaroff.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the Finance Committee. For the record, Senator Zaroff, Senate District C. Thank you for the opportunity to have the bill before us today and also to be able to comment on the bill. What the Senate Bill 92, the committee substitute does basically is it allows the Division of Elections to include on an REA ballot an advisory question if it's adopted by the regional school board in the area. Right now, the provisions there that are allowed under 1408.071 basically just reflect the ability for the Division of Elections to just deal with the school board, and we have found there that in the Senate District C that there was one REA that wished to have a question on the ballot, and there was no mechanism for them to achieve this since there was nothing in the statute that allowed that. So we put together this bill, and with the approval of the Department of Education and also the Division of Elections, the language that's before you is what has been accepted, and basically it allows the regional school board of the REA to, by resolution, approach the Division of Elections and to say that we would like to have this advisory question placed on the ballot before the next school board, or on the next school board election. And it's just not something normally there that any organized borough would be able to do on its own. And this gives, currently the process I understand would be that each community in an REAA has an advisory school board. They could conduct their own poll within their community and then try to tabulate everything there and put it all together. And it's time consuming and cumbersome in which to do that. So,
Senator Zaroff, if we put this onto the motor voter bill, could we get your vote for it?
On the what?
The motor voter bill. When everybody loves to hate.
She shot up her votes on
the bill. Other questions for Senator Zaroff? What's the will of the committee on the bill?
Chairperson, individual recommendation.
Okay, 92 is moved with individual recommendations. Does anyone object? Great. Thank you, Senator Zaroff.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go then to Senate Bill 256, Increased Aviation Fuel Tax. And Senator Sharp, I am shocked reading one of these letters that says you have put forward a bill that increases the cost of fuel in Alaska by 28%.
Madam Chair.
Which I know you didn't do. Senator Sharp, what we've got in our files is the Transportation Committee substitute of their bill relating to the tax on transfers and consumption of aviation fuel. We have a revenue fiscal note sign-outs from Judiciary and Transportation and the DOTCA position in support, along with Commissioner Campbell's request for the bill and the 1994 legislative intent. Senator Sharp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, let me make this perfectly clear. This is the Transportation Committee bill. Probably a couple of members of the Transportation Committee. I didn't look at how they recommended it out.
Well, they must have snuck it in without you knowing about it.
I've got all kinds of letters, Chairperson, if I might interrupt, that I've never seen before in your packet.
I'm the same way.
They just came in.
Never seen these. Never got it.
They just came in this morning. Past 24 hours. And I got a phone call yesterday from someone who said, how could you possibly even bring up a bill that raises our fuel cost by 28%? And I said, I'm sure the bill doesn't do that.
I only got one copy of one letter.
A ticket to Anchorage to Juneau is $444. That's right.
I get them from Atlanta and Los Angeles. I'm getting very tempted to adopt
it. Senator Sharp.
Madam Chair, this legislation, as I say, was introduced by the Senate Transportation Committee, and it is to more or less address the statement in last year's operation budget that where the situation was noted that rural landing fees of rural airports should not be considered to look at another source of revenue because of the expense involved in collecting landing fees at rural airports, and the more or less honor system on which they're reported in many cases makes it more difficult to collect it. The ones that larger concerns that has a accounting system and record keeping system that is accurate are the ones that apparently were paying their fair share, but the collection cost was exceedingly high for every dollar collected. So this primarily is introduced as an option to the landing fees of rural airports. There are organizations that do support it. Without it, I assume that the operating budget for operation maintenance of rural airports is going to be $1.7 million short, which because they might have to consider reinstating the rural landing fees if this doesn't pass, and that's so be it. But this is an attempt to address the intent language of last year's budget and see if this is a viable option. You'll note in the bill that it sunsets in 2000, I believe, and also it prohibits the enactment of rural landing fees while this tax is in effect. And if they do enact rural landing fees during that time, this seven tenths of a cent per gallon would go away. They can't have both, in other words. Basically, that's it, Madam Chairman.
Okay. Questions for Senator Sharp. Senator Sharp, can you run through us? Frankly, I guess the Air Transport Association are the majors, it looks like.
They say the two Alaskan operations, Alaskan Reefs, these ones did not share their view.
And I know that Northern Air Cargo supports the bill. And I thought, well, we have the lobbyists here, what's the Alaska Air Carriers position?
Air Carriers support the bill.
Let's let the heroes downstairs make the decision.
Oh, yeah.
Is that what?
So let's let the heroes downstairs
make the decision. Madam Chair, my information, although I don't see a letter in here, my information was that Alaska Airlines had indicated non-objection.
They say in my letter. They say that.
Well, it makes sense. Every airline in the state that lands at the rural airports would rather have this spread the cost rather than landing fees. And
Alaska and Reed do not share the same view.
Testify, Reed. Come on up.
Does United even come into Anchorage?
Yeah. Both Anchorage and Fairbanks.
Reduced New Mexico by 40%.
Although it's interesting because what FedEx and I think UPS both have feeder planes and trucks that go to, I know that they fly stuff down to Kenai and then distribute. So anyway. Mr.
And Chairman, for the record, I'm Reed Stoops on behalf of the Alaska Air Carriers Association. With respect to Alaska Airlines, you might want to check with them further. It's our understanding that they're actually net beneficiaries under this bill, that they would pay less in fuel taxes than they would in landing fees if landing fees were the alternative. And I think there's been some mixed correspondence from Alaska Airlines. So it's my understanding, based on conversation with Kim Daniels yesterday, that Alaska Airlines is does not object to this, but you might want to check with them directly. I think just to reinforce what Senator Sharp said, we're very appreciative of Commissioner Campbell's efforts last year to suspend the landing fee program, which none of the carriers liked, which went to court, which was thrown out in court, caused a lot of problems for us and for the department. And we agreed with the commissioner when he made the decision not to reinstate the landing fee that we would not object to a fuel tax increase that would raise an equivalent amount of money to what was being collected, because we felt that this was a fair tax. It was more net money was generated to help pay for operations and maintenance, and it was just a better alternative. Obviously, we don't like to be taxed any more than anybody else, but if the alternative is to diminish the hours of operations at rural airports, or cut back on snow removal or other vital functions, that's also not something that the carriers can live with either. So it would be our recommendation that either the bill be approved, or alternatively that DOT not be penalized the $1.5 million or so that this would raise, so that we don't end up in a situation where the commissioner is forced to make cuts that are going to interfere with commercial operations this next year.
I would think, frankly, that all the members of the ATA shown on this list on the March 23rd letter that are opposing the bill in some way have to benefit from having the feeder lines coming into Anchorage and going back out that provide either passengers or cargo throughout the state, with so many of our villages and major towns not on the road system, and our reliance on air travel. If obviously somebody's going to pay more if we don't have the upkeep at those rural airports, or they just aren't going to be able to provide the service.
Yeah, that basically summarizes the position of the association, and I think it was a more divisive issue when Commissioner Turpin proposed a 2 or 2.5 cent increase, which would have almost doubled tax. At that level, the tax would have raised 3 or 4 times more than was being collected, but at this rate, we're talking about a modest contribution of $1.5 million, and the DOT's budget is at the point now where we're beginning to see cuts that really adversely affect the operations of the airports. The internationals are in pretty good shape because they're still raising a lot of revenue because of the major carriers, but the rural airports don't have the same base of taxable support.
Senator Sharp, do you have any idea, or did you have testimony in your committee, what our jet fuel costs for the carriers in Alaska through the consortium in Anchorage and Fairbanks are versus West Coast airports? Do we have any idea? Or Pelvy, do you have any idea?
I don't, although it's my understanding, basic understanding, that the cost of doing business at Alaska airports, such as Anchorage and Fairbanks, is substantially lower than other airports elsewhere in the country, although there's a wide range in the world.
That has always been my understanding, including our fuel costs being relatively low.
But I
don't know.
The reason is because oil's been carrying us for 15 years.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I am anticipating some information on that within the next couple of days, and I would like to incorporate that in the bill file, possibly before we move.
Okay, so Senator Sharp, you'd like us to hold the bill. Okay.
Until that information is
Senator Kelly and Senator Reagan.
Just an observation. You know, the statement, while other states like New Mexico have reduced taxes on aviation fuel by as much as 40%, it's hard to put perspective on that unless we know how much New Mexico was charging.
Right.
I was in Albuquerque 3 weeks ago, and they have the nicest airport I've ever seen. It is just well done. It's new. and it's got the Southwest architecture, mm-hmm. and it's just a nice feeling airport. But that's expensive. Albuquerque is only 500,000 people. You go up to Santa Fe, and they don't even fly jets into Santa Fe. New Mexico is essentially a poor state. In order to pay for that airport, you know, they might have increased their taxes on aviation fuel 10 cents, and then they had to back off. So it's difficult to accept that statement at face value without knowing a little bit more about it.
The Albuquerque Airport is the only airport in the state of New Mexico with scheduled jet service.
And I would imagine they had to pay for that airport with high aviation fuel fees, but it is a gorgeous
It's a former
airport.
Military field, and they've converted the military field, and they've got the new passenger terminal on the north side, but Albuquerque never had to pay for they don't have to pay for their security, for example, or at least a portion of it. I shouldn't say all of it, but they don't have to pay for a portion of it. They didn't have to pay for all the fencing. They haven't had to pay for some of the things that I know we've had to do in Anchorage and other airports in our state because the military provided it because they're right there with a base. Same runways. Senator Rieger?
Sure. A different question, but I'm wondering about the effective date clause that the repealer takes effect any time up to January 1st of the year 2000. And wonder what the logic was of that date. It seems quite a ways out. I'm wondering if other dates like 1998 or 1996 were considered for the implementation to revise the, put their CS in.
No, there's nothing sacrosanct about the year 2000 other than there was a desire in the Transportation Committee to have a sunset in there, and that was the date that...
That makes sense.
...drive that coming out of Transportation.
Or the chairman of the Transportation.
Besides, it'll be somebody else's problem in the year 2000.
Well,
Jalmar might still be.
Yeah.
28% increase in the tax. But
right. Yeah.
They're kind of overstated.
Of course,
other comments? Okay, Senator Sharp, we will hold this bill until you want it brought back before the committee. On the other hand, I would hope that it does come back in some form because we do need, although you've got the transportation budget, I don't, but I assume we need to figure out how we're going to do rural airport maintenance.
Did you think you were going
like to
check some of the other
since I fly to them.
Yes, through the chair, I anticipate getting some additional information. What's today? Wednesday by Friday or weekend on what the impact would be on fuel cost differentials.
I wonder if you could have your staff call New Mexico and find out just what their fuel tax is today, because any information might be old. And
sure.
Senator Sharp, I think that the Anchorage International Airport may have that information, and the reason I think that is they're constantly bidding against other airports to try to get carriers to come in to the state, and as part of the sales package that they used when Gina Marie and Bob Poe went down, for example, to Memphis for FedEx, they had all that information. I don't know if they've updated it. They could show you our rates and fees beside every airport on the West Coast, along with how often we were open and they weren't, and so on. And we might save a lot of phone calls if they still have it and if it's updated.
Okay. Thank you.
And I don't know who's in charge of marketing there right now, but probably can help you find the right person. Tomorrow's schedule. We are going to start at 9. The majority has a meeting with the governor at 10:30. It was the only time apparently he could meet with us, so we're only going to have an hour and a half. It was brought to my attention that when I said we'd bring 2:15 back tomorrow, tomorrow is the anniversary of the Exxon Valdez. I thought it was next week because I always think that it's Good Friday, which isn't next week, but Easter does move. So rather than have the risk of having oiled birds thrown at us or something, we are going to switch the schedule. We'll do the supplemental bill tomorrow. Senator Frank will be chairing, and then we'll do 2:15 on Friday morning at 9. We don't have floor session on Friday. So what I'd like to do on 2:15 on Friday, we'll begin at 9. We'll go until 10:30. Commonwealth North has four people coming down who want to give us an overview from 10:30 to 11. Then we'll come back. I'm sorry.
An overview on what?
On some budget things that they came up with. Then we'll come back to 2:15 if necessary at 11, continue taking the testimony, and I would hope we could move 2:15 on Friday. Senator Rieger?
Just to comment on 2:15, as long as we have time here. You know, bill has grown to where I think it's getting ready to collapse under its own weight with all the twists and turns of how, you know, how money flows. And it's as time has gone on, I've observed that every time that, whether it's by constitution or by statute, we try to describe flows of money, we end up getting caught up in our own tangled web sooner or later. It's just, I don't have a good solution for it, but I think that the concept that's in 215 is good, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's some way that we could carve that down to about a page and a half and say, this is what, you know, we, you know, this is what we intend, and let it go. You know, it's just getting real cumbersome.
Yeah. Senator Miller met with some of the interested parties in 215, and they don't care to discuss changes, and therefore he doesn't really want to discuss changes, and it's his bill. And frankly, I've attempted to bring forward a couple of things that I thought made life a lot simpler in 215, and it was like talking to that wall over there. So I've given up, and it can go the way it is, and everybody can do what their conscience says is best, except Senator Rieger, if you want to pull it into Hess, that'd be great. Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I don't give a lot of weight to the DEC arguments, frankly. You know, they like to pretend they're the only Dutch boy with their hole in the dike, but the reality is that LAS is spending $60 million out there on a service program every year. That the Coast Guard, and there's new federal legislation involved, the Coast Guard is active.
In Prince
it's not
Williams.
Just Alyeska that's keeping those tankers off the rock.
No, that's true in Prince Williams Sound. Senator Kelly, the SPARS people, spill prevention and response people, don't just respond in Prince William Sound. They respond all over the state. And I think we do have to keep that in mind. God knows I know how much Alyeska spends every year on serves, and I think they've got the best operation in the world. No doubt about it.
Me, it doesn't hurt to shake things up on some more. The nickel barrel is small enough that we're watching all the problems that occur out there.
One of my concerns yesterday, the testimony shows, unless we, the legislature, appropriate the interest off the accounts into the account, which we've never done. We've always used it as GF, and it's gone somewhere else. We've never appropriated that money into the fund. We won't have enough money to continue the spill response division as it's been running. And what's going to happen is the operating budget people are going to be trying to figure out where to get more GF to pay those costs, most of which, not all, are legitimate costs. I think we've gotten rid of in the bill the things that the legislature caused most of the problems. We're the ones that spent money on the ferry. We're the ones who reached in to spend money on the Whittier Tunnel. We're the ones that reached in to those cash streams to pay for a bunch of things. But we've got underground storage tanks back in, and we're cutting the amount of money going into the accounts. And whoever's got the DEC budget next year, I don't envy them. Actually, 2 years out, I think next year they'd probably be okay. But we're going to have to appropriate all that interest in every year, and we haven't been doing that.
We didn't use 470 for Whittier Tunnel.
Oh, yes, we did. We used Exxon mitigation
dollars. Used the Exxon.
The first $15 million that come in this year of Exxon money, and that goes into the 470 account, and that's part of the money that's in all of these, you know, all these cash flows.
It's not the nickel barrel portion.
It's not the nickel barrel portion, but it's part of the money that comes in that we're saying, oh, they don't need
let's take the money
a nickel a barrel because they're going to get this money. That's what we've, you know, that's what's been attested to, that we don't need the whole nickel.
DEC wasn't, you know, didn't issue stock because they're the biggest growth industry in Alaska.
Anyway, Senator Rieger, I think that we have created a Byzantine method that is going to cause us some heartache.
I think so. You just read that. Try to read that bill. You know,
it's impossible to follow. But I have also found, I have made the attempt, I've actually made the attempt to try to bring both the administration and the industry to the table to try to talk through some things, and they've all got their heels dug in. And so be it.
Madam Chair, it started out at 2 and 3, and now it's 2.5, 2.5, and is the third floor griping, or is it just DEC?
The third floor has said that it's 3-2, or we'll go back to the nickel. Whether that means the governor will veto it, I don't know. But that is the third floor stance, told to me by Mr. Ryan. Anyway, I share your concerns.
Madam Chair, my opinion is, just will throw it in here, this is DEC's budget, current budget, is a lot like an individual having a major medical policy with a $2 million limit. If you ever run out, at least you run out with dignity.
That may be. I noticed that we cut it some last year, but it sure wasn't the spill prevention folks we cut last year. Apparently, they made a good argument for...
We cut spill prevention.
Not as much as you cut some other areas. We're also taking away their ability to use program receipts, which we had told them that they could... we gave them the ability to charge program receipts in the air quality bill when we passed it last year, but in this bill, in 215, we're taking away their ability to charge for contingency plan reviews, along with cutting the amount of dollars that they're going to have coming in. So we're tying both hands behind their backs.
And as far as I hear, you have an emergency.
Don't they have their plans already in place?
No. Plans have to be redone, looked at every 3.
Oh, yeah.
And Tim, they're not all in place. We don't even have plans for most of the non-crude non-crude facilities throughout the state.
Well,
plans are in place, all of them. We don't have even plans yet for a lot of the non-crude facilities.
But a lot of them don't need plans because they're under the limit, right?
Many of them are over the limit and don't have them yet.
Well, I mean, DEC's got to keep busy, I guess.
I think they are.
They got to keep funded.
Oh, they got to get a paycheck.
Senator Rieger?
They can jump into the Gold Creek